I'm in a glass case of emotion.
Hey, welcome to Cinema Sessions, the podcast where film fanatics who happen to also be therapists geek out about their favorite films, sharing therapeutic insights, character deep dives, and a healthy portion of non-clinical nonsense. My name is Rick Gutterson, and I am joined today by my co-host, Kayla Tuttle. How are you doing today?
I'm not even going to try to make this like punny or anything. I'm just really excited because this is my favorite movie we're talking about today.
This is your favorite movie. I've got to cover my favorite movie in the past with my brain just went right back to the future. There we go. I was thinking about this movie, and we are covering Dirty Dancing. Kayla, what is going through your mind and your heart right now as we are entering into this space?
Oh, it's just such, it's one of my it is my favorite movie. It's such a coming of age film. It just encapsulates so much of womanhood. And I also kind of come from a dancing background a little bit. So I love that. I love the soundtrack of this film. It just, all the feels.
Oh my gosh. Kayla, would you say that recording this episode might be the time of your life?
Now I have the time of my life.
I would absolutely say this is going to be the time of my life.
I think so too. I will try not to yell "Hey, baby!" too many times, but I can't promise it won't come out. I don't know if you saw this a while back. I tagged you in a video from like 5 years ago on my Facebook that my wife posted of me. I don't remember where we were driving, but this song comes on and it just does something to me that I can't not dance and sing and shimmy. So she recorded me singing both the leads, both the male and female parts, and switching back and forth between the deep voice and then that falsetto. And she's just laughing and cracking up as I'm singing along. And she posted on Facebook, and you know, a normal person might get upset. And I was like, I don't care. It's fun. And the amount of banter and conversation afterwards, I was like, this video lives in infamy 5 years later. So I don't know if you saw that or not, but I just wanted to share that with you because this song does something to me that no other song in the history of music has ever done to me.
I think it is one of those, like, even if you weren't, you know, like a big fan of the film or even like not that into music, you have to dance and sing along to this song. That's why it's the big dance number.
You can't just dance. You have to like shimmy. I don't know. There's a shimmy that's involved with singing that song. I don't know where it comes from. I'm a terrible dancer, but I just feel the need to
shimmy.
Rick's
going to choreograph a flash mob routine to this song, and we're all going to do it.
I love it. So yeah, sign up on our Instagram page for our Dirty Dancing flash mob. Apparently it's very therapeutic. Well, so we're jumping. I'm so excited for this episode, Kayla. I'm excited for you, Kayla. I'm excited for your mom. Your mom has posted numerous times about how excited she is about this movie. So this is a shout out to your mom as well for this episode.
Yeah, I think I watched this movie for the first time with my grandma, my mom's mom, but you know, watching it at like 12, 13, and watching it as an adult is a very different experience.
Very different. Yeah. Like, what does this mean?
Like, I liked it at the time. I thought it was fun and like, you know, campy, but there's just so much going over your head at the time that you're not really picking up on the nuance of.
Yes. I'll save my story for a moment about my kind of first experience with this movie. So we're going to be jumping into the movie Dirty Dancing today, and some of the therapeutic themes are interesting because it's really just about this young girl who's transitioning from teenage to adulthood and dealing with these adult desires and adult situations and adult decisions and the things that girls struggle with kind of making that transition. So we're going to spend some time with that. We're also going to dive into some of the real life therapeutic themes about the actress Jennifer Grey and some of the struggles that she had that are really interesting to talk about therapeutically. And then we're going to spend a little bit of time also just like, how do you help someone like Baby, or how do you help someone like Johnny? And so we want to bring like a clinical insight into helping those characters. Encourage you to follow us on Apple, Spotify, or any of the other platforms out there. We could use reviews. We would love if you would review this podcast. You could put the stars on there, but if you would write out a review, take some time, that would be amazing. It would help out the show tremendously. And then share it with your family and friends, and follow us on Instagram. It's Cinema Sessions Pod on Instagram. We can follow us there. I usually try to post like a couple of video clips from each episode on our Instagram page for fun. And I'm hoping eventually to do something with YouTube and post those on there well, but I'll make an announcement once we're able to do that. All right. So Kayla, Dirty Dancing. This is a 1987 film. This is before your time. This movie predates Kayla. I was 7.
It does.
I think I shared this before at some point, but I remember that my mom or dad or both watched this movie, and I was not allowed to watch it. So I had to stand in my bedroom and I would hear the music playing and I would dance. And that's when I got hooked to that song, was as a kid, because I couldn't watch it. And I just heard this song and I'm like, what's happening? And for a little boy who's curious and imaginative, like, I just wanted to know what was happening and it wasn't allowed. So I just felt like this song was just like the gateway into this world that I wasn't allowed to be a part of. But I just became just obsessed.
Did you understand why you couldn't watch it? Or like, I just feel like that'd be such a weird association for that time to be like, it sounds so musical and fun and like silly. Like, why can't I watch this?
But it's funny because the title of the movie implies something that is a portion of it for certain parts, but it's really, you know, when you hear the word Dirty Dancing, you think this is going to be a smutty, filthy movie. Yeah. And it's like, oh, there's swing dancing and yeah, there's some gyrations. There's some thrusting maybe in certain scenes, but there's also just like this sweetness to it that the title doesn't exactly capture. But at its core, it is a dancing movie, which leads me to my curious question.
Excuse me, I have a few more questions if you don't mind.
Kayla, we are going to put on our dancing hats for a second. Let's put ourselves into the situation, right? You are a seasoned professional as a dancer. If you were in the situation like this movie presents, where all of a sudden your dancing partner is just eliminated and you have to choose another partner to take their place, what movie character would you pick to step in and dance with you?
Ooh, movie character. I don't remember his name. What's his name in Saturday Night Fever? John Travolta.
John Travolta! Yes!
Wouldn't he be an excellent dance partner?
He would be an excellent dance partner. I mean, it would be a very distinct style for you.
It would be. I don't know if you saw the follow-up to that film, also the same character, Staying Alive.
I've heard it's one of the worst movies ever made.
So it's funny, we watched it for one of my bad cinema nights that we do, where we watch the worst movies ever made, and it ended up being one of those oddly satisfying, fun movies to watch because it also had really good music. So we were like, of the worst films, this is one of the better ones.
I have the visual now of Kayla on the dance floor with John Travolta just doing this, like, you know, the disco dancing, and like that would be a very powerful image. Yeah. I initially went to another John Travolta movie, one of your favorites. I went to Uma Thurman at first from Pulp Fiction. But then I started to think about the logistics of it. I don't have any dancing skills whatsoever. And she participates, but I don't feel like she could guide me or lead me the way I would need to if I was in this role. And also, I don't know how I want to deal with the whole like overdose aspect of that situation. So I'm going to avoid that character. And I went a very different route. And I think this matches my skill level and my need much better. I chose Mary Poppins.
Okay.
She's assertive.
She's going to hold your hand.
Yep. She's going to walk me through it. She's going to teach. Also, she has magic. And these beefy legs of mine, they need some assistance. And so I feel like her magic could just get me into a state of fluidity that maybe another dance partner couldn't do.
That's true. She could. Maybe she has like some of those dancing shoes she pulls out of her magic bag, and these help you embody this masterful dancer.
I would need all the help I can get. But if you put on that song, though, I feel like it might just ooze out of me on accident. Here comes the shimmy. Hey, baby.
To be like, Rick, that's not the routine. And you're like, I don't care. This is what I'm doing.
Exactly. Like, Rick, you know, that's not even the song that we're dancing to. I can't help get it out of my head. Oh, so
that is so like strange to me when I watch movies and you think about, usually they don't know what song they're going to dance to when they're doing a dance sequence. Mm-hmm. So if you just imagine, it's like it's either silent or someone just kind of humming like a basic rhythm. Mm-hmm. And so like they're dancing and it looks like it goes to this song, but they don't always know what they're going to dance to. So it just feels really awkward to me.
We'll talk about the making of this movie in a little bit, but there's portions where they had to just do some of these scenes to a click track because this song came in last minute and they didn't know what they were going to write the routine to. So they had to do it to a click track and found this song that kind of matched up with it. But it's a crazy story. Kayla, I had one more partner I thought about, and it's not for any strategy. It's just for my own amusement. I could not get the mental picture of you dancing with Napoleon Dynamite out of my head.
Okay, if I was going to do like a interpretive dance, he would be. Yeah, I guess it really depends on the style of dance too that you're presenting. Like, do you want like a well-rounded dance partner? Do you want like just ballroom? Do you want like hip hop? That would really depend.
If you did a hip hop dance with Napoleon Dynamite, that would be amazing.
There you go. Well, for that, I'm probably picking someone from, what's that movie? You Got Served. Did you ever see that one?
No.
It's like a hip hop dance routine contest.
Oh my gosh. Well, we have a lot of options. Who would you pick out there? Like, who's your last minute dance partner that you'd pick? You have to let us know when we upload this onto Instagram. You have to post that in the comments. But we want to hear your thoughts. Who's your last second dance partner that can fill in and sweep you off your feet and make a crowd go wild? I think that would be very fun.
Next season is all dance movies. Rick is here for it.
I'm down for it. I love it. All right. So, Kayla, could you give us a simple synopsis of the movie Dirty Dancing for those who haven't seen it in a long time?
Yes. And if you haven't seen it, you should go back and watch, especially if you haven't seen it as an adult, that's I would say, because it's very different. So this movie is about Frances Houseman, a.k.a. Baby. And she embarks on an adventure with her family.
Baby! Kayla's holding up a Funko Pop of Baby.
I know, I have my little Baby Funko. I wish I could.
Nobody puts Baby
in the
corner. Nobody puts Baby in the corner.
So Frances, she comes from Baby. She comes from this family that is very well-to-do. They're not, you get the sense they're not really used to having to ask for much. Dad's a doctor. He provides for the family. And they go to this country club every summer. But this summer is a little different because Baby is now emerging into adulthood from her teenage years. So here she meets Johnny and the rest of the country club staff, and she gets to see a whole new world that exists beyond this narrow viewpoint that she's had of rich, successful doctors and lawyers and that sort of thing, into this whole other world of freedom and dirty dancing and just all these things of what it means to be human and be connected aside from what she's used to in her family. Hmm.
So interesting. This movie is just has so many iconic moments and iconic things that are about it. Like, what from this movie just speaks to you, Kayla, as a young girl growing up watching this as a 13-year-old, now even as an adult? Because, I mean, you put this at the top of your, like, all-time favorite movies list. Like, what is it about this movie that just speaks to you? And is there a certain like scene that captures that for you?
Yeah, like, I think I just love, one, it's just like very nostalgic to me, but I think I just love it so much because it's such a time where she's so baby's surrounded by all these people who are telling her what to be and how to dress and how to act and all these things. And then she finds this very odd niche world that she kind of fits into, but in a really odd way, but they see her very honestly of who she is. And one of my favorite scenes is when they're practicing in the dance studio, and it's the Lover Boy song scene. When they're like, they're being silly, like talking about like their posturing and stuff, and they're like spaghetti arms, and like she's like making fun of him of how he instructs her to dance, but she's like on the other side of it now. But it's kind of like a scene of she's grown enough confidence to make fun of him now. Yeah. So I really like their dynamic.
Is that the one that, baby?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of falsetto singing for me. I apologize in advance for nothing.
We're going to do a whole episode where Rick just sings the soundtrack.
Oh my
gosh.
It's
going to be awesome.
Good times. So before we jump into some of the specifics of the movie Dirty Dancing, I had some questions about like what's actually happening in this film as I was watching it. So let me ask you this question. Is this movie essentially a summer camp for rich people that features dancing as their primary activity?
Yes. I think dancing is like the microcosm through which we understand the wealth disparity of these two different cultures.
Because you see different areas of dance that are very different from each other, and the populations are very different. But I started thinking that I was like, so if this is a summer camp for rich people and they just happen to be dancing, just like other camps might build fires, does that make Patrick Swayze like the dancing equivalent of a camp counselor?
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially what he is for adults, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Like, that's a very interesting... So I'm now going to view this movie through, like, a weird summer camp lens where, like, seductive Patrick Swayze is the camp counselor. He's kind of like the summer dance camp pimp. That's my nickname for him.
Yeah, because there's a lot more sexual components than just your average camp counselor, from my understanding.
Yeah, you try to usually mitigate the amount of sexual components of a camp counselor.
that's
not
what
a
you
trait
don't
I'm
want.
Looking for when I'm bringing on a staff member. But in his case, it's like he's the draw. Like, hey, let's pimp him off to all the people to get all mm-hmm. the people coming into our weird dance summer camp for rich adults.
Oh yeah, you have all these ladies that are like there, apart from their husbands, who are wanting to dance with him. Yes, he's definitely the poster boy for this summer camp.
Do you send that out on the flyers? Like, is your marketing your summer camp? Like, come dance with this dude. He's hot.
Yeah, I think he's probably on all the flyers.
Seductive Patrick Swayze. Oh my gosh. This movie is out of control, and I love every part of it. All right. So what is it about this movie that like ropes you in and keeps coming back? Because it's super rewatchable. Is it the music? Is it the feeling that you have watching this movie? Here's what I'm thinking. I've watched a lot of these movies, and there's things about the movie that like the theme or the narrative draws you back in. This doesn't have any of that for me, but yet I feel compelled to, even like as we were talking about it, go back and watch it. So I wanted to ask for you, like, what is it about this film that just ropes you back in and wanting you to have more from it?
I think the music definitely has something to do with it. It's, if not my favorite, it's one of my favorite film soundtracks. I could just listen, and it goes all over, right? Like, there's like some slower music, there's some dancing music, it goes everywhere and in between, so that's really cool. I like the dancing aspect. I also think they're just like such iconic characters, mm-hmm. which is part of it. Like, there's just so many classic scenes to it. And two, I think we're drawn to, I was thinking about this recently with reading. So I really like reading books about, you know, like going off to boarding school or going like Hogwarts, like Harry Potter, going off to school, going off to this magical place. And so like summer camp also kind of exists in that realm of, we're outside of our normal day-to-day living, and we're going to create this environment that's magical in its own way. And I think this kind of does this in a very, although it's very real and this could happen.
Yeah.
It also kind of exists in that space.
I like that comparison, like the magical world of Hogwarts to like this magical fantasy, like fairy tale world of Dirty Dancing, or if you're like, the movie starts off, she's in the car, they're driving right there. So this is a world that kind of like time stops for them. And it's also kind of like, you know, it was made in the 80s, but it's supposed to be, is it supposed to be in the 40s? I was trying to remember what decade it's, or is it the
60s? I think it's like 50s or 60s, somewhere around there.
Yeah, so it's like this time, distinct time period where it's just like, I can check all this other stuff off and just park in this fantasy world for a couple hours, similar to what you did in like a Harry Potter or a Lord of the Rings or a Star Wars. You know, even though it's not a sci-fi movie, I like that parallel of going, I like to exist in that world for a couple hour period of time. It's a really fun world to be in. That's really an interesting way to world it. So one of the things I wanted to ask you about was, you know, that's about this movie that's really cool, is like you see her get transported to this brand new world that she's never experienced through that weird watermelon scene. She's carrying this watermelon and she's like, oh dear, what have I discovered? Like, so when you see that scene, like, what goes through your mind of like, you know, her facial features and, you know, just her experience walking into this weird underground sultry dance environment while she's holding this large voluptuous watermelon?
Well, I want to say I did really consider, so my stomach is very big right now as I am 9.5 months pregnant. I did consider painting my stomach as a watermelon and showing up and saying I carried a watermelon, because what better time to do that?
Right. You don't get the opportunity all the time to paint your tummy as a watermelon.
But yes, that is an iconic scene. Yeah. I mean, that's like where she really starts to see the difference of like, this is a whole nother world, but she's fascinated by it. Like, if she was like, she's definitely like kind of uncomfortable, because I don't think she's ever been exposed to anything like this before, but she's very fascinated and interested in, okay, these people are so free. I'm not used to that freedom. Like, what is this? It's not just rebellion for rebellion's sake. It's more like, how can I discover more about this? And we get a sense that she's kind of a free spirit anyway, because they talk about her wanting to be in like the Peace Corps, which, you know, that just doesn't come out of nowhere. Like, she doesn't want to be a an attorney or a doctor, or like anything that would be like considered successful in her family. And her family kind of makes fun of her for that. But this is very outside of the world that she's used to.
Yeah. It's interesting. There's a lot there. It's not just the, oh dear, there's a lot of grinding happening in this room and a lot of sweat, minimal clothes. But there's also this, like, how are these people so uninhibited?
Uninhibited.
Yeah, there we go. It's a large word. That's outside my like three syllable limit. So I was trying to swing for the fences on that one. But yeah, there's just,
well, and she's seen dancing before, but like in a very like structured ballroom, hold your frame, and here we're gonna do these 4 to 6 steps. Like that's how she's used to seeing dancing, and this is like, whoa, what is going on here? They're just free and it's open and the music, and it's a lot of sensory differences.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting. It's fun to think about it though, in the sense of, it's not just the desire that's there. It's also the freedom. I like that you pointed that out. Keila, I asked you about this a little bit before, but there's this really fascinating documentary that's on Netflix called the Movies That Made Us. And they have a lot of different classic movies, some of which we've covered on this show. But they do one of my favorite episodes on it was actually breaking down Dirty Dancing. And so I wanted to play a little game of Did You Know? Because you said you maybe watched some of that out there, but I imagine a lot of the audience hasn't necessarily watched that documentary. So did you know that the title Dirty Dancing came first before they ever wrote the plot or the script?
It makes sense for one of those, for like this type of film.
Mm-hmm. It's such a vivid, the producer of it, the eventual producer, heard that title and she goes, that's a $1 million title right there. Let's talk to you about like writing a script that follows it. But it was the idea, and it started with this woman just telling her story. And she's like, and it's funny, the documentary goes on to show like her nickname was Baby. And she would go to these dirty dancing clubs and she would do, and there's a lot of parallels in her story to what ended up being written about this character. But that title, Dirty Dancing, stuck with this movie producer's mind, and she just couldn't shake it. And so they based the entire plot around this title that grabbed her attention from this woman telling her story.
Wow. I feel like with a title like Dirty Dancing, it could have gone in a lot different direction. Like you were saying, kind of the seedier, like,
yeah,
club, like, I don't know, there's mobs and gangs and, mm-hmm, you know, that sort of thing. But this is very different. It's like polished society and the undercurrent of the, mm-hmm, Dirty Dancing.
Yeah, you imagine like a West Side Story turf war style, like these two dirty dancing clubs fighting for power and control against each other.
That's kind of what you think of, yeah.
I think you know this one, but did you know that there was real life frustration between these two lead actors, between, yes, Patrick Swayze and Jennifer Grey? Talk about that a little bit, because I know that you mentioned that before as well.
Yeah, I don't know a ton about it, but it is one of those like classic. This one, and then what's the other one where it's, I think 50 Shades of Grey was very similar to, different film, but like, it's so funny because it's these movies where it's intense chemistry between two characters, but off screen, they could not stand being in the same room.
Yeah. There's scenes in this documentary. It talks about certain scenes in the movie that were real life frustrations. I think the one, I don't remember what part is, but he's, like kind of tickling her arm down to her side and she keeps giggling and he's getting really frustrated at her.
Uh-huh.
The documentary talks about how I think she was having like blood sugar issues or something and got super silly and they didn't have any food handy or something. And so it was a late night shoot and he was just getting so fed up and they just used all that footage because they show that like in a montage almost back to back to back. Mm-hmm. And that was all real footage that they thought was interesting enough just to throw into the movie when he was legitimately really cool, just getting frustrated that she couldn't focus. I was like, I love
but
this.
But it works.
It works. It's for the so dynamic. Good.
Yeah.
All right. This is a kind of a pop quiz for you. Do you know what movie that they were both in together previously before this movie that led to some of that frustration?
Ooh. I don't.
Before starring in Dirty Dancing, they were both in the amazing 1984 crazy action movie called Red Dawn. It's a movie where the Soviets invade the United States and a group of kind of like militia rises up to try to stop them and save their friends. And so Patrick Swayze's in that movie. Jennifer Grey's in that movie. I think Emilio Estevez is in that movie. A couple other people from the 80s.
So they already had a working relationship.
And it was on that set that they started to have some kind of frustrations or whatever. And so then coming into this movie, knowing that their history was there, they were a little hesitant to kind of jump into it.
Yeah, okay, I didn't know that. I think I saw the remake of that film, if I'm like Chris Hemsworth.
Chris Hemsworth, yeah. I like that remake. It's very it's a very Rick movie.
It is a very Rick movie.
So good.
What is Chris Hemsworth in that's not a Rick movie? That might be anything.
Gosh, I love both the Extraction movies that are on Netflix. Those are great. Those are actually pretty well made too, but they're definitely cheesy, ridiculous movies. Of course, Thor. That is a good question. He's a very Rick actor. You know, yeah, what I had heard, this is totally off topic, but I don't think it's in production anymore. But at one point he was rumored to actually, they were going to do some kind of wrestling movie about Hulk Hogan, and he was going to play Hulk Hogan. And I would have been like,
that would be fantastic.
This is my dream.
Yeah. You still need to see The Iron Claw.
Oh also. My gosh. I cannot wait to see that movie. I really want to see that. I've heard it's incredible. Oscar level drama that's also about wrestling.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
I know. I'm like, this was made for Rick. This really.
I love it. All right. So one other interesting thing. Did you know this movie had a really hard time getting produced? So they wrote this script and nobody wanted it. It got shopped around to all of the different studios and nobody wanted it because it was like this weird schmaltzy title and who wants to watch this? So it got rejected and ended up being dumped in this tiny little VHS distribution company called, what was it called? Vistion, I think it was something like that. I forgot the name of it. And they picked up and they had never made a feature film before. They were like a B movie direct to videotape company. As a production company, and this is their first movie they ever made, and it made so much money, they never made a single hit after this, and they went bankrupt. Despite all of the cash that this movie made for them, they couldn't replicate the success.
Wow.
Absolutely crazy to see this. This movie was like huge profit, but the producer had, this is getting super nerdy, but I think it's just fascinating, had structured all the payouts in a way that all of the key people, like the directors and the actors and all those people, got all the money. The studio, there wasn't a whole lot left for them.
And so they didn't have any like seed capital to keep producing.
Yeah, so they put out a couple of movies. There's one movie that I remember watching from my childhood. It's the only one I even recognize that they also made. It's called Little Monsters with Fred Savage. You ever heard of that one at all?
No.
I remember watching it as a kid. So that also came from the studio, but they went bankrupt not too long afterwards because they couldn't sustain the success and they kept trying to swing for the fences on more movies. And this is the only hit that studio ever made.
That's what's so hard about, I mean, granted, I'm not in it, so this is just my perspective, but the film industry is because you need all this talent and creative types, but you also need the very logical business-minded people that are going to be like, how do we get from A to B? How do we make enough money to ensure ongoing success? Like, you really need a blending of the minds in this sort of field.
Yeah, it shows how like these accidental things can happen, but if you don't know, because that's the other thing that the documentary shows, like none of these people had ever done these things before. They hadn't produced a movie, they hadn't directed a movie. It's all firsts, and it just kind of worked for some reason. And it's amazing that this movie still holds up for the most part, and yet it kind of got made by accident. It's incredible.
That's so interesting. Like in the time that it was made too, it seems like a film that really fits into kind of the zeitgeist of that era. So I'm surprised that people weren't interested in it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very fascinating,
but also it probably went through a lot of rewrite. Like we don't know how much edited, like what it existed, you know, first on the page versus what we see on screen.
Right. Right. Yeah. The only thing I written down here, I wanted to ask you about, so I'm pretty sure I know your answer on this, but I want to talk about these five movies that Patrick Swayze put out in a very short period of time. This is like a 6-year span, I think. Red Dawn, Dirty Dancing, Roadhouse. Have you ever seen Roadhouse?
Yes.
Okay. Ghost. And then Point Break. That is a pretty insane five movie run in a 6-year span.
It is. And Point Break, it's not like one of my favorite movies, but that's like a nostalgia movie from when I was younger. I loved that movie.
I am an FBI agent. So good. Well, if you had to rank those, I'm assuming Dirty Dancing is one. What's your number two?
Dirty Dancing is one. Point Break is probably two. Probably Ghost.
Okay.
Roadhouse. And what was the other one?
Red Dawn. You haven't seen that one yet.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one. So, I mean, that one could rise.
Yeah.
Like the dawn. Who knows? Who knows?
Rise like the Soviet Union trying to take over. That is an amazing, there's a lot of actors that have made those kind of stretches, but Patrick Swayze in his like kind of, he's not a B actor, but he's not like an Oscar acclaimed actor either. He's kind of like in that middle tier. Like he's epic.
Like, way better. Well, I'm not even going to say way better talent, different caliber of talent, but he's kind of like a, almost like a Nick Cage ethereal type of like, mm-hmm. never really got the like acclaim, you know, like critical acclaim, but like everyone knows him. He's beloved, that sort of thing. Of his movies are very culty. People love them. They gravitate toward them. His character, his energy. I mean, even like his skits on like SNL and stuff. Like he was just one of those really like pop culture kind of icons.
That when you talk about picking our dance partner, that skit is me. It's if Patrick Swayze chose me and I was doing a Chippendale striptease. Like, this is my alter ego. I love that skit so much. He's like, then hey, your dancing was great. It's just you're just too fat. He's like, yeah, I know. Oh, it's so good. I can't believe they got away with that skit. I guess it's a different time, but...
Yeah, so, you have to think about when this stuff was put out. It's very different.
So ridiculous. I love it. You know, the Nicolas Cage is an interesting example because looking at like Nicolas Cage's action movie run from the mid to late 90s is similar. But even him, he had won an Oscar prior to that run. So he had a lot of mm-hmm. critical acclaim and then just chose to kind of pivot into these crazy action movies and then these direct-to-DVD, you know, movies after that. Where Swayze didn't necessarily have any of that kind of critical acclaim. He just was a guy that led movies that were really successful. Mm-hmm. Such a fascinating career. So sad to see. Was it pancreatic cancer that he developed?
I think so, yeah.
Such a sad ending, but he just has such a short window of like fame and just these beloved movies. It's incredible. And of course, then you can't talk about Jennifer Grey without not talking about Ferris Bueller's Day Off as well.
Of course.
It's incredible. Did you know that... that she, I think it was during the premiere of Dirty Dancing. So it had already been shot, but it was, the movie was premiering and they were kind of doing the promotion stuff that he and Matt, she developed a real relationship with Matthew Broderick after Ferris Bueller, but they were in a car accident and she and Broderick had significant like injuries and then two passengers died. And this is like during the kind of the promotional premiere of Dirty Dancing. I had never heard of that until doing some research on this film. Were you aware of that?
No, I haven't heard of that.
I can't even imagine like processing like not only your own injuries, but then this trauma of like someone died in our car, but also trying to promote a film like that. That just has to be torture.
Yeah, because you're probably scheduled for all these interviews and press appearances, but then also struggling with this very deep personal trauma. I can only imagine.
Yeah. I mean, trauma is hard, but to have to do it in a public light. I'm surprised that I didn't know that.
They're asking you about it and yeah, like it just gets really dicey about like their personal life and the professional roles.
I couldn't even imagine if social media was around back then. That would be, it would just be so hard to hide from all that stuff. Kayla, let's transition into our therapeutic themes. You know, Dirty Dancing, I don't think it's a movie that often people would think about like, hey, there's a lot of deep therapeutic themes in this
That's
movie.
That's why I watch it. Yeah.
Except for this, of course. But there are some really interesting themes when you unpack it, just about like this transitioning from, you know, young adult or, you know, kind of adolescence of a girl to like young adulthood. And you see her journey, like she's such a sheltered, studious, daddy's little girl at the beginning of this movie, right? So what are some of the struggles that you see that she experiences in this movie transitioning from teenagehood into young adult woman that summer that you think that maybe the average girl might also experience?
Yeah. The biggest one is lack of exposure. Like, so we don't really know necessarily, they kind of hint at, you know, like her trajectory and like where she's from and where she's meant to go and that sort of thing. But I mean, you can kind of tell by the way her family is like pals with the, like the owner and the serving staff, and they're trying to even matchmake her with that guy that's really boring that she's just not that into.
Has that ever happened to you?
Like,
hey, you should check out this guy. Hey, Kayla, I want to see all the cool things I know and take you around. It's really, really a cool place.
Thankfully, I met my husband very young, so
he wasn't like that. He
didn't. No.
Hi, Kayla. How you? Can't
picture no, Calvin. I don't like think that. I could get past that. No.
Starting to plant that seed for you.
Yeah. I mean, she sees this whole other world. Like, I think the biggest thing is like knowing concepts on paper and then like seeing them in real life, right? Like, so we go to school, we like learn about these things in the world. She's very sheltered. She's very daddy's girl. She's not really exposed to all these things. And then they talk about her wanting to be in the Peace Corps and, you know, go out and experience life in the world. But as far as we know, like, she's never really interacted with people from lower socioeconomic status. She hasn't really seen a world outside of this country club, rich lifestyle. She's definitely interested in seeing those people, but it doesn't sound like she's ever really interacted with them. So getting a real sense of, okay, this is what I want to do, or this is the kind of world that I want to be a part of. And it doesn't just exist on paper, but this is actually a reality that I'm starting to see.
So, I mean, she's exposed to so many new things all in such a short period of time. And she's seeing, you know, I kind of broke it into like three categories, these new situations, like you mentioned before, like the class divide and like mm-hmm. these two different like worlds that she's exposed to. Like she's always been a part of the rich, wealthy crew. And now she's seeing like the underclass or the poverty or the, you know, kind of lower class, kind of working income people. She's exposed to like these adult situations where like, you know, there's the woman who's pregnant and doesn't want to keep the pregnancy, and you know, the, you just kind of the struggle and like what's going on, even Johnny's kind of low self-esteem and the struggles he's wrestling with. And then just these desires of like, you see it in her face as she's holding that watermelon, like, whoa, like mm-hmm. I'm just awakening these things. There's this hot, sweaty Patrick Swayze who's just so dreamy, even though he's maybe 10 years older than me and might create some ethical issues here. How do you process all that in real time? Because like, who do you talk to about these things? It's a whole new world. Like as a young girl, like I imagine there's a temptation just to hold that inside and not talk to anybody about that.
Yeah. I mean, she doesn't really have anyone to talk to. Like we don't see her. I mean, granted, this is before the age of a lot of technology. And so I think it would be very different if it was made now, you know, like she'd probably be like chatting with some gal pals back home. Oh, I met this guy, Johnny, whatever, texting. But yeah, she doesn't really have anyone to bounce these new experiences off of. So it's really just internal. You get the sense that her family does not talk about these mm-hmm. sorts of issues. Again, very sheltered. They're not talking about emotional experiences or other ways of living. They're just kind of in their own little bubble, especially at this country club, because it's, you know, they're on vacation and the expectation is everyone's going to have a great time and we're not going to talk about anything, you know, other worldly or downtrodden or anything that's going to, you know, try to get at the sense of well-being that we have. But it's so internalized. Like that's a really hard part, I think, that would be tough for her, is even her sister has a very deluded sense of the, like she doesn't really get like the real implications of what's going on. And mm-hmm. her sister very much wants to exist in this very successful world. So yeah, I mean, so much of it's internalized, which I think is kind of, I mean, it ends up working out for them ultimately, of course, but yeah. To have your world be so internalized is a really hard thing for a young girl.
It's interesting too, like you see the struggle in wanting to communicate parts of her inner world to her dad by asking for help, but not being able to communicate why she needs help. Mm-hmm. And that tension of like, I imagine as a young girl, you're kind of like, I'm exposed to all these new things. I want to trust my dad with this, but I don't know if I can, and I don't know if he'll trust me. And then how he reacts or doesn't react is going to dictate how safe she feels to continue to open up or not. So you see him responding in certain ways, but also he responds with a lot of judgment. He responds with a lot of, you know, protective concern, which I think is a good thing. Like, I don't want my daughter to be exposed to these things, mm-hmm. but it also kind of starts to create more and more of a divide between them two as the film goes along. So it does create this tension of like, I used to trust my dad with these things, but I don't know if I can trust other people with this new stuff. And now I'm navigating really hard situations as a young person who's not necessarily ready for this yet. That's a hard position to be in.
Yeah. I mean, you really get a sense that they have a really close relationship. And if he's who she's most used to trusting in this world, like, and probably up to this point, that's served her really well. Like, right. Like it's all things that he could have handled in their relationship together. But if the person I trust most in this world is bringing judgment and shame and trying to get me out of this situation, then who else am I going to go to at this point?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a hard situation, especially when it comes to like a romantic partner, right? I mean, let's look at the data on this. Now there was some discrepancies on ages that I was looking up, and I think it's probably a good thing there's discrepancies, because it changes the dynamics tremendously of this relationship. Some people say baby was 17. Some people say baby was 18. Uh-huh. Obviously, there's different state rules, but either way, it's a lot easier to think of this story as a girl who's 18 and just graduated than a girl who's a minor. So we're going to take the 18-year-old. Sure. His age is somewhere between 24 and 26. So mm-hmm. even if we take that small gap, 18 to 24, that's still a six-year window of I just graduated high school, and this guy's a grown man looking, even mm-hmm. if he's still younger. And he's very attractive, and also everyone here desires him, and I'm learning through getting to know him, he's probably been with a lot of these older women. That's a really hard position to be as a young girl. Like, mm-hmm. I can't speak to that experience. That's help people go into the mindset of, like, what do you do as that young girl? Because you want to be open about it, but also you have these desires that are kind of awakening, you know, mm-hmm. as this young woman, even if this isn't necessarily the way that you thought they would be awakening, right? So, talk about that mindset as a young girl, kind of gaining that adult, those adult desires, I guess.
Yeah, even that, like, development period, like, the difference between 18 and, let's say, 24 is so much more impactful than, say, like, if you were 32 and dating someone 38, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's just like a very different phase of life, of where you're at, what you're used to. Brain development wise, he's a lot closer to his brain being more fully developed. He's had a lot more experience. She's had no experience. It's interesting because she's used to having status on one hand, like this financial wealth, means and opportunity status. But the status that Johnny has is a very different, like, he's more respected by this culture that she wants to be a part of.
Yeah.
It's a different level of respect and status. And she wants to be a part of that. And I think she realizes that that's ultimately more important to her than having the kind of status and success that her dad would want, or her family, what she comes from, would want for her. But yeah, wrestling with that. And, like, also, I don't get the sense that, you know, her family took her aside and had the sex talk and said, here's what to expect as your body changes. Mm-hmm. And you start to have these desires, like, I, especially like at that time.
Right.
Like, if this is in the 60s, this was not happening. Like, I think probably the best you could hope for was, like, a Bible and a pamphlet on sex before marriage, or, like, whatever, you mm-hmm. know, like, you're not really getting the whole, here's how your body's changing, here's what your emotions are going to do. It was so much less comprehensive than we get today, or hopefully that mm-hmm. you get today. So she doesn't have anyone to bounce that off of. So my body's changing, my world is changing, I'm having all these desires, I don't even know what this is. Like, it feels really good to be around this person, which even that can be really, like, it also depends, you know, when we're meeting baby in this journey, because I would be really cautious, like, you know, if I'm, you know, like her therapist, say, like, telehealth, and she's at the summer camp and she's like, oh, this Johnny, like, I don't know what it is about him, but he's just so attractive and I just want to be around him. You know, mm-hmm. that would really make me nervous, like in a helper, like, sort of position, being like, oh, okay, you've never had this amount of, like, excitement in your life. Your mm-hmm. life has been very routine, very expected. You've been given everything that you've wanted. So this desire of, I want a whole world different than this, and this is my link to that. Mm. Like, it's not just the sexual desire, but it's so much more that comes with it.
Well, and it's also these other pieces that are attached to it, right? It's not like this boy is showing me attention and I like it. There's also, like, mm-hmm. we're trying to practice and perform. The situation is dictating that our bodies are close to each other, right? Yeah. There's, and the other thing that's really interesting aspect of it is she's seeing the emotional pain and struggle of another person who's going through an unwanted pregnancy. As mm-hmm. she's also developing these desires for this guy who, I don't remember when she realizes, because at a certain point it's implied that he's the father, and then you realize he's not the father. I don't remember when she learns that information, but all along it's just mm-hmm. like this kind of hodgepodge of things. Like, she's being fed in real time, like, you know, this information about that, while also trying to navigate her own desires for him. And also there's this, like, bad boy element where he's, in real life and in the movie, really not that interested in her. He's very frustrated by her. And yet mm-hmm. it almost makes her want him more because of that, because of his unavailability almost, right? So there's, like, some of that relationship dynamics potentially with her dad, even though they have a good relationship. I wonder if, like, some of that emotional unavailability from her father she sees in him. And she's like, I'm used to this. This feels comfortable. Also, this dude's a beefcake and I love him.
Yeah, I think that dynamic is definitely at play of, you know, like, I want, if you're used to, I mean, Freud would have a lot more than I say to have to say about this, but if I'm used to having this male attention and okay, I found this vessel, this human being that I want this attention from, and I'm used to just getting that attention really easily because I'm a daddy's girl, but suddenly I'm having to work so much harder at it, but also mm-hmm. it's a lot more validating when I do get that attention mm. because I have to work so hard for it. I mean, that's very reinforceable cyclical nature. That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. It is interesting to think about that relationship dynamic on that level. Because there's a lot to that that's going on. It's just like, how do you process all of this new information that's all bombarding you all at once without people to talk to help you navigate through that? And mm-hmm. I think she does a pretty good job with some of the things, but you also see the tension that I'm now starting to deceive my dad. Like, she makes the conscious decision to, like, I'm going to lie to my dad. And you see her, like, I think she asks for the money for the abortion for the, mm-hmm. for the friend. And he says, is this something illegal? And she's like, no. And you see that break in trust and that kind of consequence. Then she starts to make more and more decisions that deceive the dad. And it leads to that really powerful but heartbreaking conversation in that gazebo looking over the water. And they finally mm-hmm. have that really a good heart to heart moment. And, but you see the struggle with, like, I'm not used to talking to my dad this way, and I'm trying to make these decisions and not knowing how to navigate them. And I'm hurting people around me as a result because I care for this guy and I'm trying to protect that. But I'm also hurting the people that I'm closest with as a process.
Yeah. And she's so used to just having decisions made for her. Like, you don't really see a lot of agency or choice that she has. Even like, I think it's like when they're preparing for the talent show and they're like telling her what she's going to sing or like, you know, like they're just used to kind of assigning roles in this family and this culture that she's a part of, instead of being like, baby, I wonder, you know, what you're interested in. And they kind of even make fun of her about like the things that she's interested in. About dad's like, oh, baby wants to help all the starving people, like, ha ha ha. Like, but it really kind of diminishes her sense of self. So she's probably not used to being able to speak up for herself. So this is really hard for her to be confronted with. I have to make this decision. I know that ethically, like, according to my family, this wouldn't be the right decision because I'm lying. Mm-hmm. I'm not creating trust. But also, I feel like this inner sense of this is the right thing to do because I am helping this community that I want to be a part of and care for.
Yeah. I'm thinking about, like, if you grew up in a sheltered environment, and I grew up in a private school, and, you know, I was fairly rebellious in the sense of I'm just going to do my own thing anyway. So I wasn't like a just listen to everybody else kind of person, personality wise, but overall, like, you're in this bubble of a world, and all of a sudden you're thrown into this brand new world where you're an adult, you can make choices, but also there are situations you never dealt with. Like, that's a very hard environment to start to go, like, how do I start to begin practicing my own autonomy and self-determination as an adult while also, like, dealing with things I've never seen before in my life? Like, have you ever been in a situation where you're just kind of thrown into this whole new kind of like Hogwarts fantasy style world and having to make like crazy adult choices where you've never been there before?
Yeah, kind of. So like I grew up in the South, and I came from this very, Southern religious culture, but then that, and then you're thrust into the real world, and then there's peer pressure and all these decisions to be made along with puberty and changing body and drugs and alcohol being entered into the picture and all of these different things of, okay, I'm really confused because this culture says that they really want this, but then this culture is asking me to do these things. So it can feel very confusing to be like, which one do I want to be a part of? Which one's the right way, when I'm seeing lots of people on both sides, right? Like, I don't know which way to go.
And then you add Dreamy Calvin going, hey, Kayla, into the picture. And next thing you know, you're carrying around a watermelon.
He's always a yes. That's the easiest decision.
You're very good looking. I'm not attractive.
There's no application, but I just love that line from Happy Gilmore. Just feel like every once in a while, you just have to incorporate it.
There you go.
I love it. So I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, let me change the flow. Before talking about another therapeutic theme, I want to talk about, so let's pretend that we're going to see Baby and Johnny as clients, right? They've got some stuff that they're navigating. Let me do this. I want to have you talk about, like, how would you come alongside Baby in this situation, because she's dealing with a lot of the stuff you mentioned, kind of like, if you were seeing her virtually, she's off at this crazy grinding sex summer club with a pimp. And she's learning all this stuff, and you already have some type of therapeutic relationship. How would you support someone like her as she's navigating this whole new situation and new desires and new thoughts?
Yeah, I think it'd be tough, because if she's thrown into this world of exposure so quickly, it's like we'd almost have to titrate her experience and like action level, like depending like what she's doing. So instead of just going in with like full force impulsivity, you know, I found this guy, I want to just have a life with him and be with him and be a part of this culture. Like, it's just so, it can be very alluring. Mm-hmm. Instead of thinking of, okay, well, you've never really had agency in your life. You've never really had control and autonomy. Like, how do we start? Like, not to say that that's not a good idea or that you don't want to do those things, because ultimately you might make that decision anyway, but just thinking more like, how do we build towards that agency? Mm-hmm. And like giving her more confidence with stating her needs, having autonomy, but also while encountering this new world, like how does she still get her own needs met? Because mm-hmm. my guess is that living in this family, I mean, her safety needs, her physiological needs, like all of that stuff has been very taken care of. Mm-hmm. We don't get the sense that she's ever struggled, but more like her emotional needs, like have those been met throughout her life? Was she able to ask questions? Was she able to raise concerns? You know, how do we build her voice? And then let's work on building your voice and having agency before we enter you into these experiences where you're going to have to make some tough decisions.
I like that idea of building those blocks slowly and stuff while she's in kind of like in this new environment. I think that's a really wise thing to do. Especially, it would be an interesting environment to have, like, okay, so here's what happened this week at Weird Pimp Summer Camp. Let me check in with Kayla and just process it all in real time.
I mean, it'd be like real world, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like in the moment exposure, like titrating and seeing like, does this work? Does that work? And even saying, you know, so I was invited to two events. One's like a country club soiree and the other's like this grinding dance party in someone's basement. Okay, which one do you want to go to? Like, what does your heart say?
How much sweat is involved in both? Give me, on a scale of 1 to 10. Oh my gosh. No, I think that's a really wise thing to help her kind of process that in real time, to help her feel confident in her decision-making. And also, like, we don't always get every decision right. Mm-hmm. So what's important, you've talked a lot on different episodes about core values and helping clients identify core values, even through like, you know, those cards that you can have, helping like what matters most to her. So like, she seems like she's very into like, you know, kind of social justice and like helping people and serving other people. So she's going to see this lens through this, like, can I use my status or privilege or position to come alongside other people to help? But also, I'm really young and you know, immature or not exposed to a lot of these real world things, and I don't know much about it. So helping her decipher these situations through like her values, I can see you doing a really mm-hmm. good job of doing that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. How do we filter it through that? Like, is this, and you're going to mess up, but also that's part of learning how to be an adult, is to deal with the consequences and okay, how do I adjust that and do better next time?
Yeah. All right. The most important therapy question to have for her would be, how do you help her process the dance at the end, right? She's got the moment, the whole place's eyes are on her. She's on the stage. She gets lowered so dramatically to the ground. She gets her run up. I thought about asking you to reenact with me, but you know, to have you lift me up in the air, but you know, I don't want to cause any harm to the baby. So maybe after pregnancy, we'll practice this where you can lift me up into the air. But she runs and she jumps, and it's the moment. Patrick Swayze holds her up in the air. She's balancing. She has all the glory, and she comes down. She has this beautiful dance and everything. Like, what, man, how do you, that's just such a cool moment. Like, how would you share with that moment with her as a therapist?
Oh, that is an excellent question. Oh yeah. She's like top of the world, but like, so one, it'd be like celebrating, right? Like, oh, that's wonderful. Like this moment, like mindfulness, let's live into that. But then the other part is like, life and this relationship is not always going to be that wonderful, magical existence. Mm-hmm. So then we have to talk about the reality of it. If you're going to have to come down from that wonderful embrace at some point.
Yeah. Cause if you chase that high and like, that's what you think this relationship is going to be, summer camp's going to end eventually. Mm-hmm. And you've got to go back to your job or whatever school you want to go into. you're not going to always have the moment to be just held up into the air and have the spotlight on you all the time. And if that's what you, the expectation is, man, it's going to fall short all the time and you're going to be miserable in this relationship or any future relationship.
Yeah. I don't even know if I've really thought about it before, but like, honestly, like baby Francis and Johnny, like, I don't know that they're a couple that would really make it in the real world beyond, you know,
yeah.
I think there would be some honeymoon glow to this period. They'd write letters back and forth. Maybe he comes to visit her once or twice, but they're just in such different worlds that can their relationship sustain outside of this magical summer camp?
Yeah. And I don't know that, but I think it's an interesting segue because when you think about what Johnny's issues are, there's a lot of, he's got a lot of stuff. He's kind of got that emo kid inside of him, even though he's this like, you know, sexy beefcake of a man. He's just also like so insecure. And the thing I thought about, which is really interesting because, you know, there's a lot of stereotypes about men and a lot of stereotypes about men are very true, right? One track minds, all that stuff. You know, we can joke about all that stuff, but like he's being used by women and by the club to attract women to this place. And you see it wears on him. And you don't hear a lot of guys admit to that thing. We think about women who've been used and mistreated or kind of like sexualized, but we don't think about that often with men. And you see it's actually really taking a toll on his self-esteem. Like, or he already had really low self-esteem and this is, he doesn't have the ability to say no or have boundaries. And as a result, he just gets taken advantage of because this is the only value he can find. And you see that big struggle with him. And I could see, you see it play out in the relationships of sometimes like, how his insecurity weighs in on her, even though he's much older than her and she has a different type of insecurities, that could cause a lot of damage in their relationship.
Why do you think he's so drawn to baby on a personal level?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I suspect it's she's so innocent and there's there doesn't appear to be any gamesmanship from her. She's just like, wow. This is amazing. You're amazing. Whereas all the other women just want something from him and want to use him or are like, he's the boy toy to their husband. Even it seems like, you know, like, hey, pay this dude. He's going to dance with you, give you a good time. Cause I'm not going to meet that need for you or whatever. And it's like, he's the escape from all the other women's reality, but she's so innocent. She doesn't bring that same kind of manipulative presence into this. And so I imagine that there's like an innocence. And also if he's thinking about like safety and control, like he's going to be more in control of this girl who's younger and has less experience. So he's going to be able to dictate terms more, I think, which is going to protect him. I think more so than the older women or the ones that have a lot more life experience where he's kind of being used by them.
Yeah. He gets to set the terms of the relationship a lot more.
And you see him kind of dictating that, like kind of in the pace of, you know, it's, you know, done through the lens of this dancing montages and stuff. But one of the scene that you described earlier where she starts to dictate the terms of the dancing is when you start to see the relationship become more balanced in the power because she's feeling more confident dancing, but she's also becoming more confident just as a person, you see. And he's actually learning, okay, so I can actually let my guard down and not need to control everything. It's kind of a symbolic switch in their relationship.
Yeah. Okay, so Rick, I'm imagining Johnny's probably not going to come into a therapy office. I don't really see that happening.
Right.
But you might be like a wise older buddy or maybe you work at the camp. You're like a different kind of camp counselor.
I'm not the pimp counselor. I'm a regular counselor.
Yeah. You can be on all the flyers, Rick. Is that what you want? Hey. Come dance with Johnny. Come talk to Rick.
Actual camp therapist. Dance with Patrick Swayze and talk about your feelings with Rick.
So if you had a short window with Johnny and maybe you only get one or two questions to really make him evaluate where he's at in life, what he wants, you know, what he wants out of his own journey in life, what are you going to ask him?
Oh, that's so hard. I know what I want to ask him, but I have to think about the order, right? Because if you just jump to who are you? And who, you know, who do you want to be? It's, you know, because he's so guarded in those things, I think that's really tricky. I think one of the questions I like to ask him would be like, what is something that you love about yourself for you, not based on what other people tell you that they love about you or need from you? Because he might genuinely love dancing, but if dancing is also the source of his pain, he might actually grow to resent it, even though it's bringing in money. So what is something he actually loves, like is passionate about, something that he wakes up and thinks about? And what is something about himself that he actually likes or enjoys? I think finding ways to affirm himself would be really important, because a lot of times people with low self-esteem and shame, like, we're just not used to feeling good about ourselves. And it's hard to then see ourselves through the correct set of lenses, where other people might see his strength or his resilience, or, like, I think about his fearlessness and how he confronted the dad, or the fearlessness that he showed standing up on the stage of, like, hey, I usually close this thing out. They told me not to, but I'm here anyways. Like, there's a resilience and a courage to him. You know, some people could look at it as that as being defiant, but that's a natural strength of a leader that you could see in that. And so helping him start to recognize those things about himself, and then building on to, like, what is it that you would like to do? Who are you as a person that's not defined by what people have used you for, and starting to build that area. But I think trying to get to know him as a person, I would want to know, like, what does he actually love? Is that people tend to, even if they don't like themselves or struggle with their self-esteem, like, can still often talk about things that they love or things that they enjoy. Now I'd have to do all of, so if he started talking about dancing, I'd have to do a lot of reading, because I'm not very well versed in that. But at the same time, I think I just want to get to know him. And I think the most important thing to me would be know that there's not an agenda. Mm-hmm. Like, these questions are sincere and I'm curious. It's not because I'm trying to manipulate him, because he's been manipulated by so many people. And so just to, like, hey, I care about you. I'm interested in you. Who are you? Because I want to know, other than it's just because I want to know you. I think that would be really important.
That'd be really hard to build a relationship with him, like, for him to let his guard down. Like, depending on who you are in his life, like, it'd be really hard to build that rapport and trust component, so he trusts you enough to know that you don't want anything from him.
So I think that's so the skill in that, and I'm just kind of thinking off the top of my head here, but people who've been through struggle and grew up in other challenging areas don't always know that other people have struggled too. Especially when they see, like, okay, this person's got their master's degree and they're doing these therapies. Like, what do they know about pain or hurt? So I think there's a lot of self-disclosure in those moments of, like, hey, you're right, I don't know that struggle, but here's how I grew up, you know, and here's the struggles that we went to. Yeah, we almost lost our house in this, and, you know, didn't have a whole lot. I got made fun of the clothes I wore, and we had to buy stuff at Salvation Army, and got made fun of by all the kids, and was the unpopular cool kid. Like, all, I was part of the circle of popular kids so they could make fun of me, because someone has to be the uncool kid with the cool kids, and just all of that stuff that, like, shows that you may not know the exact circumstances, what it feels like, but you've been through hard stuff too. That often can be a really good trust building thing with people who have gone through hard things, because there's such a mindset of, like, when I've been through something hard, you don't get me. How could you ever get this? And so you can't manufacture that and fake that, but I think if you can do things to build trust on that level, that show that you can understand that either personally or understand what's happening underneath the surface and relate to that, I think that would be really important to someone like him.
Yeah, I think he'd really have to be able to see you as an equal, like, in order to open up to you. Because if you were on some pedestal, even, like, perceived of, you know, we're going to bring this psychologist into the camp or, like, anything like that, where it'd be like you have wealth or status or there's some sort of reason for you being there, would be very different than just connecting.
Yeah. And I guess all I'd really have to do is show him my dance skills. I'd be like, oh, this dude is not above me at all. Let me show you my shimmy. And he's like, you know, dude, I think I believe you now. Yeah. You're not my superior. I'm like, no, you are right. I cannot dance.
Yeah. That would be, hey, that's a way to make yourself vulnerable in front of him.
Yeah. There's a lot of vulnerability. I'd break my leg probably. I would probably drown in the river as I'm trying to do the moves. You know, he'd be like, I really feel, he would be just as frustrated, if not more frustrated with me, because I'd start giggling all silly and but that would be a way to let my guard down. I'd have to step into that space of, like, I need to let go of any professional credentials that I'm feeling or any kind of sense of pride that I take in, like, these degrees or whatever, just to go, like, in order to meet him on his level, he needs to see me as a human being and not as a therapist. Because he's not going to trust somebody to open up.
I'm just re-envisioning all these scenes of Johnny and Baby, all these ways of them becoming closer. But imagine Johnny and Rick, but these are all, like, trust-building exercises of, like, walking on the log and, like, the car and the dance routine. It's like, this is your therapeutic journey together to connect with Johnny.
I'm crawling on the ground. Baby, tell me your feelings. Oh my gosh.
Nobody puts baby in a corner.
Hey, we're all about unconventional therapy here.
Whatever you got to do, man. If I got to wear tight shirts and get myself all soaking wet in order to build that therapeutic rapport, I am not above it. Unconventional. So here's how I want to end. Normally, we don't split up with therapeutic themes, but this movie is really interesting. I started kind of touching base with you about it before. The real life therapeutic themes of the actress Jennifer Grey are really fascinating. I think it warrants spending a couple minutes just talking about it. Kayla, there's a couple of things that are really interesting about her life that are very unique to her and her story post this movie that I've not heard too much of in other Hollywood stories. So real quickly to summarize, like Jennifer Grey has a very distinctive facial feature, right? She was in Red Dawn, she was in Ferris Bueller, and then she's in this, and she just became like this hit icon, and then she just disappeared. One of the things that she's recently wrote about, she put out a book, like a memoir called Out of the Corner, like Babies Coming Out of the Corner. It's really clever. But she calls it Schnozmageddon, this big controversy about her nose. And a lot of people may have heard about this, but I think it's worth repeating. She had got a lot of fame, but she was kind of insecure about her nose prior to some of these things. And a few people have started telling her, like, you should have gotten surgery on it to fix it. After the success she's had, she decided to have the surgery. And the first surgery didn't go exactly as she wanted it. So she had a second surgery, and that surgery drastically changed the look of her face. So All of a sudden, Dirty Dancing, she's on top of the world as actress, and now she's unrecognizable as the girl from Dirty Dancing. So she would go places and be like, oh, you look similar to that girl. Like, oh, I am that girl. Like, no, you're not. She looks like this. And her entire identity was just robbed of her. Like, nobody knew who she was as an actress, as a person. It not only impacted her financially, but also like from a self-esteem standpoint, from a mental health standpoint, because everyone's now just talking about her nose. Like, how do you as a person, like, how would you approach the real life support in like helping Jennifer Grey as a person kind of like navigate this distinct identity crisis that she went through after this movie?
Yeah. Who knows? Right.
Hey-o.
No, that would be tough. Like this facial feature. That's so hard because it makes you want to kind of like villainize the people that are saying you need to make these changes or you need to do that. And then she made this decision that however young she was, that she had thought that she had to make to fit in. But
because it's also coming right off the back of that traumatic car accident. When you put in that part into the time frame of like the trauma of that, this newfound fame, and now the surgery, all kind of wrapped up into one thing.
Mm-hmm. So you're very front and center in the media with all of these things going on, but yet you don't really still have that sense of self, and everyone's focused on this one body part of you. I mean, I think like with that, I would honestly probably taking a step away from acting in the spotlight and just having her encourage, you know, her own pursuits of similar to like Johnny of like, what do you just enjoy doing that you don't necessarily get attention for, but that you love. And it could be acting, but maybe you do, you know, theater or you do something else like in the media film industry for a while just to see, you know, if I take a step out of the spotlight, do I still feel that sense of judgment or shame or do I still love doing this?
Yeah, that's a hard thing because like when our identity is based on what we've done and what people think about us, and all of a sudden nobody recognizes me for those things. That's a really hard piece of ourselves to lose, and it involves a lot of grief. I like the idea of stepping out of the spotlight to like emotionally process all that and say, okay, so how can I rebuild my sense of self-worth, not on my past achievements and if people can recognize me, but just based on who I am in this moment, because I can't now change what happened to me with the surgery. I can't change the car accident. I can't change that former success, but I can change who I am now as a person and how I process this new life ahead of me and what my new goals are going to be. I imagine this book was a very therapeutic journey for her.
Yeah. Reflecting on who you are, not just how you present or how you look, because that unfortunately is a really big part of Hollywood and the film and media industry is what you look like this package that you come in. And that's, there are so many other ways of building connection and even like performing or being in the arts industry that don't have to do with that.
Yeah. And it's sad because when you think about like, you know, so let's say this surgery fixed the problem of her nose that she had with it. And yet it, like she not only lost a part of herself, but like, I think about like, she just has such a distinct look and characteristic in these movies that made her kind of quirky in her. And it, you know, if you, you can't, you know, do this in hindsight, but you know, just helping somebody love who they are is so important. I've always admired the work that you've talked about doing, like helping people navigate shame and body image issues, helping them love pieces of them and then learning to appreciate the other pieces of them, even if they don't necessarily always love them. You know, it would have been amazing to help her navigate that in advance. But I like the idea of like stepping out of the spotlight in after the fact to just to heal and process and to help rebuilding your life as you kind of let go of your old identity and embrace whatever this new unknown identity and new journey ahead of you is.
Mm-hmm.
Kayla, did the build up, was it worth it? We've been waiting for a long time to talk about this movie. I mean, did it live up to the hype? Did you have the time of your life?
The time of my life. I have had the time of my life, Rick. And this is the last episode of the season, right?
It is. This is the end of season three. We are on like day-to-day baby watch. I know you've probably got like a couple weeks, but like you're in that zone.
I am 2 weeks away from my due date.
We're on like the Kayla baby countdown right now. So we're going to take a break from the podcast, let Kayla be a mom, embrace all of new things, figure out what's going on for season four. Excuse me. We don't have a date necessarily to when it's coming back yet because there's a lot of unknown variables. But Kayla, this has been a fun season. We've done a lot of cool movies. We've done some fun ones. We've done some dramatic movies. We've been all over the place. What's one of your favorite moments from season three that comes to mind?
Oh, that's a good question. Honestly, since like I haven't been able to work with you and see you day to day, and Michael as well, even just seeing you guys periodically is a highlight, and being able to talk about something that we're so passionate about together, and dancing to the intro,
Of course,
always a good time. it's all been fun.
That's been some of my favorite. Like season three has all been virtual and apart. Like we were so used to recording for the first 30 episodes in person together in the same room and not working together anymore on a day-to-day basis. This is like my Kayla time. This is my social time. Mm-hmm. And it's just such a fun thing. I think one of my favorite highlights of season three was actually the Barbie movie. I felt like I got to know other parts of you that I just didn't know before, and hearing about your life experiences and talking about it in such a crazy, absurd way with that movie. It was just such a fun conversation. I think that was one of my favorite highlights. And then of course, I loved the draft. I love drafting anything. So that was just a blast for me.
The draft was really fun.
So much fun. Well, this has been an amazing thing. I can't wait to figure out what season four looks like. As soon as we get more information about when we're coming back, what that's going to look like, I'll put that out for you. But in the meantime, check out the old episodes. We've got 40 episodes plus a couple smaller episodes that we've done. I can't believe that we've been doing this for a year and a half now. It's amazing. 40?
Whoa.
40 episodes plus. It's crazy. Well, we are excited to bring back season four. Kayla, an early congratulations to you and to Calvin and to baby Edward. I'm sure you have an actual name, but until I realize what that is, I'm just going with baby Edward. And I can't wait to see your growing family and to get some quality baby time in there sometime when you guys are settled in and everyone's healthy. I can't wait to meet your growing family. This is so exciting.
Yes. Growing a watermelon.
Grown a watermelon. I also have grown a watermelon over my years. It has nothing with a baby. It's just a personal issue I'm trying to work through here. Well, we are so thankful for you riding us this journey for season three. What an amazing 10 episodes. And we are looking forward to season four in the future. Thanks for hanging out with us. We'll see you next time on Cinema Sessions.
Bye.
Do it! I'm back, baby!